I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Obama isn't stopping to smell the cherry blossoms. He's planning to hit the road later this week to bolster popular support for health care reform after last night's 219-212 win in the House. There are definitely bruised feelings to heal after a raucous weekend. Tea Party protesters, some slinging slurs, shouted outside the Capitol. Inside on the House floor, some Republicans applauded protesters as they were taken away and also made impassioned pleas. Here's House Minority Leader John Boehner.
And look at how this bill was written. Can you say it was done openly? Yes. With transparency and accountability? Yes. Without backroom deals and struck behind closed doors? Hidden from the people? Hell no, you can't!
But the bill ultimately passed, and President Obama is expected to sign it into law tomorrow.
When faced with crisis, we did not shrink from our challenge. We overcame it. We did not avoid our responsibility. We embraced it. We did not fear our future. We shaped it.
And now the action moves back to the Senate, where Republicans have vowed to derail the so-called reconciliation bill, which the House also passed yesterday. Cale Shattuck is congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. And, Cale, we just want to touch on the tone. African-American Democrats making their way to the Capitol were called racial epithets, spat upon by protesters. Anti-abortion Congressman Bart Stupak was called a baby killer when he ultimately went along with the bill. Republican Congressman Devin Nunes likened the Democrats to Soviets. We heard last week that people were saying the process is going to be forgotten. Your thoughts?
Oh, I don't think this process will be forgotten for a very long time. This was ugly in about every way something can be ugly. The crowds outside, I'd like to say one thing about them, though. You know, when you're writing a newspaper article or looking for images for television, you don't look at the thoughtful people who have just come here because they're worried or afraid. You look at the people who are drinking those racial slurs, you know, where alcohol was involved with that. You look at the exaggerated things, and, you know, part of the problem is we have so exaggerated genuine differences that it's hard to even realize there's a middle. There was one protester I talked to. He was a former software guy, lost his job. He became, a gardener of sorts. We talked for a long time. He was very thoughtful. He actually believed that this was the last time he would see his country the way it used to be. He really thought that government was going to take over things, that government would be deciding what medical treatments would be the best ones for him to take, that it was going to become very paternalistic and that we'd never get out of it. It couldn't be reversed. Whether or not you think he's right, he wasn't crazy, and he actually was thoughtful. And there's a lot more of that going on than I think the media reports conveyed.
Well, and that's probably who the president is going to seek out when he travels the country to say what's actually in the bill. Just quickly tick through some of the things that will happen in 2010 and some that will wait for 2014.
Well, I think the big things right away are things like children can't be denied insurance on the basis of
pre-existing
conditions, that young people up to the age of 26 can be included on their parents' policy. That sort of thing you notice right away. Insurance companies can no longer cut you off the minute you get sick. So some of the most, they tried very hard to move those high-profile insurance items that people would notice to the front, so that by, these phase in by, in 6 months, we're talking October, there's a big election in November. I think you're going to see some important, demonstrations about that time. Hey, look, everybody, from tomorrow on, your younger children or your young adults can be on your health policy. You don't have to worry about them.
Right. Well, but just briefly, as we look ahead to the reconciliation, Republicans are threatening to derail it. Is it assumed, though, that after maybe a lot of procedural starts and stops, that it will go through?
Look, there's one point that I think you can say for sure about the Senate floor and reconciliation. Assume nothing. They've tried very hard to vet all of this with the Senate parliamentarian, but from what I understand, he has not been clear in his responses. You know, in the past, the parliamentarian says yes, no, yes, no. He's given guidance, but he's made clear that until he sees the objection on the floor in the exact wording and context, he can't be sure of these rulings. Republicans are telling me that they have some killers here, including one that has to do with Social Security that could knock the whole process out. So, yeah, I think it'll get through, but I sure wouldn't assume that.
Okay, well, we can't assume anything. Gail Chadwick, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor on passage of health care reform in Congress, but as she says, it could be a bumpy ride for the reconciliation bill. Gail, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev surfaced recently with an op-ed in the New York Times reminding us of the incredible arc of Russia's recent history. In the mid-80s, Gorbachev instituted the system of reform perestroika to try to move the foundering Soviet Union from its rigid ideology and unbridled arms race. But top communist leaders balked and in 1991 attempted a coup which weakened reform. After the Soviet Union collapsed, Boris Yeltsin opted for even more radical reform, which plunged that country into chaos in the 90s. Yeltsin would transfer power to Vladimir Putin in 2000. Putin reinstituted a more authoritarian Russia that the current president, Medvedev, has voiced concern about, as does Gorbachev in his op-ed. But what really happened in the 90s? Mark Ames and Matt Taibbi were there. They were American expats who, for over 10 years, published The Exile, one of the most popular and most reviled newspapers in post-Soviet Russia. They were called madmen, pigs, hypocrites, and fiends, and that's a partial list from people who admired them. Because while people like Gorbachev now acknowledge that the 90s were a near-death spiral for Russia, at the time, Westerners in particular wanted the fledgling democracy to be a success and ignored the corruption and poverty that Matt and Mark looked squarely in the eye. In the spring of 2008, government agents targeted their paper, The Exile, scared away investors, and thus caused it to shut down. But now the paper's story is told by writer James Verini in the current issue of Vanity Fair. James joins us from the Argo studios in New York. James, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thanks very much.
And we also welcome back Mark Ames, who founded The Exile in 1997, later brought in Matt Taibbi. Listeners know Matt's been a frequent visitor on the program for his more recent writing for Rolling Stone. But Mark, you visited us as well years ago to talk about The Exile. So welcome back to you, too.
Thanks for having me on.
And you're 44 now, about 31 when you started the paper. James writes about you being propelled to Russia. By what? From what?
From California, from America, I guess, in the early 90s, which seemed, boring, while in parts of Eastern Europe, there was a, once-in-a-lifetime cataclysm going on. So that's what brought me to Russia. That and Russian books.
Oh, sure. In college, we should know you got hooked on Dostoevsky and Gogol. But, mm-hmm. When you say you were bored here, others have said that, well, you couldn't get hired here and so went there. Was part of that the kind of writing you wanted to do? What did you want to do? Some form of truth-telling?
You're absolutely right that I couldn't get hired. In fact, I couldn't even get hired out in Moscow by the Moscow Times. They were considering hiring me as a columnist, and the editor-in-chief, who I believe is with the Wall Street Journal now, sort of brought me inside and said, your stuff is kind of interesting, but the way you write about Moscow, Moscow in the 90s is not this wild place the way you're kind of describing it. It's a business community, and this is what people want to read about. And it didn't conform at all to what I saw, and I think most people saw there, which was it was a really messed up, grotesque, wild place. And I think most people kind of agree with that now.
Well, place us in time, because this was after the Soviet Union fell. It was being portrayed as a sort of a post-communist paradise working its way towards a democracy. And Mark, you saw what?
The place was completely devastated. It was like, the plague sort of swept through there. Everybody was drinking like turpentine and, nobody really could afford anything anymore. And people were also dying at an extraordinary rate. I mean, they were dropping off like flies. The death-to-birth ratio in Russia in the 90s was almost unprecedented in the 20th century.
So give us some examples of your targets, not just Russian authorities, but Western reporters, world bankers, Wall Street. Tell us some of the targets of your paper.
All the ones you named, definitely ourselves, half the time, because we, pretty much thought we were disgusting people, anybody who worked at The Exile. The bigger story was that there was this kind of official version of what was going on, which was that, anybody who spoke English and mouthed the usual cant about democracy and free markets and liberalizing this and that, officially those were the good people, and then officially anybody was who wasn't with that program, was some kind of revanchist, communist, fascist, or whatever. And on top of it, it was clear to us that the Westerners weren't there. They weren't on a charity mission. They were destroying the place. They were stripping it blind, making off like bandits, and empowering really the worst so-called young reformers, or really the worst, most corrupt people in Russia. Really, early on, we were kind of shouting Cassandra's, you know, saying that what's going on here is not just sort of morally wrong, but it's going to blow back in pretty awful ways. And it's stupid and it's venal and sick. And we were accused of being communist half the time and fascist for talking that way.
Well, some of the things you did, Matt Taibbi posed as an agent from the Jets in New York and to go meet with Gorbachev under the pretense of wanting him to come be a coach for the team. Matt also put on a gorilla suit and sat on the floor of Goldman Sachs in New York to protest their sale of worthless Russian debt. And then you gave the Worst Foreign Correspondent of the Year award to the New York Times Moscow bureau chief Michael Wines. Now, this is an infamous tale that James, you retell in the article. You slammed a pie
lovingly.
He gave him a pie in the face. It included the reproductive material from a male horse.
Liquid.
Yes. why were you so angry at him, first of all?
Well, one of the main targets of the exile was sort of like, well, if we're going to ruin our careers by doing this paper and sort of saying everything we want to say and behaving how we want to behave, then we want to make sure that we take other people down with us and expose them for being frauds and for screwing up the story. And so for a couple of years, we were pointing out what hacks the Western correspondents were. And we had tournaments.
What'd they get wrong?
Well, everything. I mean, there's really nothing they got right. What they were doing is they were whitewashing over and over real suffering that was going on there. Russians were dying like flies, and they were doing so under the auspices of our aid and our advice and our system and so on, and with our blessing. I'll give you just one example. I mean, Larry Summers, who's now the economy czar in the White House under Obama, this guy was writing decrees, economic decrees, sending them to his liaison, this young reformer, Anatoly Chubais, in Moscow, and then he'd have Yeltsin sign them. This is unprecedented, and they knew it, and it was all out there, but nobody would report it except for the exile.
James Verini, you talked to other reporters who were there at that time, Newsweek bureau chiefs, the Chicago Tribune. What'd they say about the exile?
They said, in retrospect, they got it right, and a lot of us didn't. This is they being the exile and Mark and Matt. They didn't buy into this narrative that the mainstream newspapers and CNN, et cetera, had bought into. They all said they all, you know, read The Exile religiously. First to see whether they were going to get lampooned. They all did. You know, they just wanted to see how badly they got torn apart. But also because they knew The Exile was presenting a side of Russia that they either didn't want to present or could not present or couldn't sort of find on their own.
You're right. One of them said, how can I get to that same story without mainlining cocaine? Because Mark and Matt often participated in the dark life they wrote about, as we're going to hear. That's James Verini. He profiles the newspaper The Exile and the founders in Vanity Fair magazine. More in 1 minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Mark Ames, the founder of The Exile, a now-defunct English-language newspaper in Russia that he published with Matt Taibbi. Also with us is James Verini, who writes about The Exile in the current issue of Vanity Fair. And James, Mark, and Matt reported on a darker side of Russia, and they lived it as well. Matt wrote a series in which he worked as a bricklayer, a miner. He sold vegetables, went to a Moscow high school. Mark went into dangerous prostitute dens, and The Exile also invited prostitutes to write their own stories in a series called Horror Stories. That's W-H-O-R-E-R. And one in particular about a prostitute that Mark visited in St. Petersburg?
I think the woman's name was Ira. Former ballet student, maybe even ballerina, and her father had been at a factory and was let go. I think it was in St. Petersburg, and it was a result of some of the reforms that Putin had actually, quote-unquote reforms that Putin had instituted in the industrial zones in St. Petersburg. And he, you know, he was an alcoholic, and she was supporting at least part of her family by doing this. And where she and Mark end up is at this apartment complex where the people are so badly off that they have to let their apartments, you know, by the hour or by the half hour to...
Old babushki or letting. Come in, pay for an hour,
To people like Ira, you know, and she carries around this razor that she shaves with. I thought it was right out of Dostoevsky, and it was the kind of thing that you so rarely read in journalism anywhere.
The prostitute story, for example, prostitution story, I mean, this, it was emblematic of the relationship between Westerners and Russians after communism fell. And it was also physically the big experience that, you know, an overwhelming percentage of male Western expats, and most expats in Russia were male because it was considered a fairly dangerous place. And to not do that story is to not be a journalist. And you couldn't get that story without living that story as well. But, you know, in terms of danger, I mean, for me, the most dangerous or frightening thing would have been to work in an office in a cubicle in San Jose, California, where I'm from. Honestly, that to me would have led very quickly to heart disease, diabetes, and a wretched death.
And Mark, I just, James in his writing says that it read like the bastard progeny of Spy magazine and an X-rated version of Purvich's Almanac. It certainly was read by a lot of people, even your enemies in the Western press in Russia. As you look back and you look at Putin's Russia today, did it make a difference?
It made a difference. It didn't alter history, I suppose, but it made a difference in a lot of people's lives. Probably a lot of people are scarred for life. But I think it was also an inspiration for a lot of people. I mean, I think a lot of writers are frustrated and would like to be able to write without worrying about all the different consequences. I mean, in fact, when this article came out in Vanity Fair, that's what I had some journalists here telling me, that it was such an inspiring story, and they wanted to start up their own sort of exile in their own, you know, what their exile would be like, not necessarily doing horror stories or something. But I think we did have a pretty significant influence in shifting the debate about whether Yeltsin and young reformers and our whole mission there was a good thing and the right thing, and were we backing the right people. And in 98, when things started getting a bit shaky and the mainstream Western press stuck by Yeltsin and stuck by reforms really as a matter of faith. You know, there was a lot of resistance to what our version of events was. And it wasn't just because we were such geniuses. It was because Matt and I went native. And we didn't really see the point of being in Russia unless you went native. Whereas the rest of the Western press corps drove around in nice Western cars with Russian drivers. They lived in nice apartments that were gated. You know, some of them didn't even know Russian, didn't know much about the history of the place. So, you know, we were the only ones who said that the economy was definitely going to collapse and that they were going to default and so on and so forth. And then when it collapsed, journalists for a while had to think a little harder before they wrote some kind of BS about
it. And that includes financial journalists as well. I spoke to financial people in finance and financial journalists who said, you know, yeah, the exile saw this collapse before anybody else did, or at least was willing to talk about it before anybody else was willing to talk about it.
And the tone was dark humor.
I think that's probably what makes the exile actually, if you guys had approached a lot of these stories without humor and without a sort of self-flagellating aspect, it probably would have been too much to report on and too much to read.
For Western readers, yeah. I think so, yeah. Because, I mean, a lot of these stories really did mess with our heads, you know, a lot of the times, and thank God for drugs, you know, to numb you a bit, because they really did. But, you know, over time, I mean, Russia under Putin started to sort of, ossify a little bit or get a little bit more predictable. And at the same time, my country was, like, collapsing like, you know, Russia under Gorbachev was. I mean, the decline in America and the corruption and the insanity here was something that I started to increasingly sort of regret not being here in my own country. And you really realize, you know, if you stay there, then you got to become a Russian. And I'm not a Russian. You know, I'm American. And in some ways, I started becoming, I think, I don't know, almost a little bit more American or Californian in those last few years, like really feeling my roots or something.
It was also becoming increasingly difficult to be a journalist in Russia at that time.
Well, yeah, that's true. It was getting scarier, and the scary incidents were starting to multiply.
Journalists were being killed. Anna Politkovskaya and Paul Klebnikov and on and on. Those are just the more famous examples. There were lots of reporters, and that has not stopped.
Yeah. I mean, we had a few scary moments in the first 4 or 5 years. But the last sort of 4 years had just, I mean, so many insane, frightening moments that they probably took a few years off my life anyway, yeah.
That's Mark Ames, founder of the now-defunct English-language newspaper in Russia, The Exile. Today, from his home in Brooklyn, he edits the paper's online version, which covers things not Russian. He also contributes to The Nation and The Daily Beast. James Verini writes about the rise and fall of The Exile in Russia in the current issue of Vanity Fair. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Tens of thousands of people rallied this weekend in Rome to support Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi ahead of regional elections this month. Meanwhile, a new political movement is also drawing tens of thousands of people into the streets to oppose Berlusconi. It's called the Purple People Movement. It's attracting Italians fed up with Berlusconi's personal scandals. Its supporters wear something with the color purple to identify themselves as being different from the official opposition parties, which they argue are giving Berlusconi a free pass. From Rome, the BBC's Duncan Kennedy reports.
Vergogna, vergogna, shame, shame, they cry. The mood is defiant at this anti-Silvio Berlusconi rally in Rome's exquisite Piazza Navona. This time, maybe 5,000 voices. At earlier rallies, the numbers have reached tens of thousands.
I don't
like him because he doesn't respect anything I believe in, and he doesn't represent any value that is respectable.
They're fed up with Silvio Berlusconi. They point to his recent alleged sex scandals, his attempts to pass laws keeping him out of his corruption trials, and his attacks on judges, who he likens to the Taliban. But it's not only the words you notice, it's the colour these people are wearing. Purple, the new expression of protest, say those in the crowd. Purple is now everywhere. Purple scarves, purple sweaters, purple bags, shoes, coats, even the collars on dogs brought by their owners to give a canine perspective on this colour coordination. Why purple? I asked Ginevra Tossoni, one of the organisers of the rally.
Purple because none of the Italian party has this colour on their logo. And also they say that it's a colour that's powerful and it means wanting to get attention. They say that kids use this colour when they're very young to get attention from the older people.
It's not just the colour that distinguishes this political movement. There's no leader, there's no party headquarters, there's no manifesto. No one can tell you exactly how many members it has. And of course, all that is the point. This is a political movement like no other. What organisation there is comes in this caravan, powered by its noisy generator. The purple protest was born somewhere on Facebook. Party machinery is replaced by a laptop. But the unifying theme to go with the colour is, says Ginevra Tossoni, the opposition to Silvio Berlusconi, Italy's Prime Minister.
I don't think it's my Prime Minister. I don't recognise him as my Prime Minister. He thinks he can change our constitution, and he treats this country as a company, you know, as one of his company, and that's not right.
A me sembra no, no, io per me non ci sono, non ci sono problemi.
And here he is, Silvio Berlusconi, meeting some of the millions of Italians who continue to support him. His ratings are down a couple of points, but he's in no electoral danger from the purple protest. He faces regional elections later this month, a referendum on him, he calls it. But whilst the purple people are not putting up candidates, they are, acknowledges Senator Lucio Malan, a key Berlusconi ally, representative of a restlessness, an unease among Italian people about the direction and style of the Prime Minister.
Well, I think we have to be concerned with what this movement expresses beyond those few thousands of people who gather in the squares, because there are many people who don't feel their necessities being taken care of, and we have to deal with that.
Purple and vocal, all ages and all backgrounds are being drawn to this movement. They say the official opposition is not doing its job, so they have to. Here in Italy, when it comes to Silvio Berlusconi, the people may be wearing purple, but they're seeing red.
The BBC's Duncan Kennedy reporting from Rome. Coming up, is the Pennsylvania woman known as Jihad Jane the new face of terrorism? That's in 30 seconds, here and now. The stories of those two American women, both blonde with light eyes, both Muslim converts, both suspected in a plot to kill a Swedish cartoonist, have faded from the headlines. But what do they tell us about where we are on terrorism? One of the women, Jamie Paulin Ramirez, is under investigation but has been released without charge in Ireland. The Algerian man she lives with is also a suspect. They met online. Her brother told a Texas TV station that his sister followed any man that came along like a lost puppy. Then there was Colleen LaRose, who called herself Jihad Jane and met an Egyptian man online. Last week, she pleaded not guilty to charges in the plot. An investigator told the Philadelphia Inquirer her life was like a country music song. Jessica Stern is a terrorism expert who teaches at Harvard Law School and joins us now in the studio. And Jessica, there's not been a lot of extended coverage of these women. Do you think it's because they were plotting something overseas?
I think it's partly that they were plotting something overseas, but also because they don't seem very scary. In fact, I think this is a frightening development. This is, you know, if we were running a terrorist organization, we would want to recruit exactly this kind of operative. This is the ideal recruit.
Well, we were also told after the spasms of terrorism and violence in Europe that kind of homegrown terrorism that was happening there would not emerge here because immigrants are more integrated into society here. And it seems as if we are seeing, in the case of these two women, something that's very different from immigrants who become part of homegrown terrorism. But on the other hand, we've seen stories recently about American immigrants or people second generation in immigrant families who have been involved in violent action here. I'm thinking of Dedal Hassan, for instance, the Fort Hood shooter, the Denver airport shuttle driver who's been accused of plotting something in New York, the young man who worked at nuclear power plants here in the States who was picked up in Yemen.
Yeah. I think that's right. Initially, there was a kind of collective sigh of relief when we looked at how Muslim immigrants to the United States were seemingly unrecruitable. Muslim immigrants to the United States mostly are better educated than typical Americans. They are wealthier than typical Americans, and they also are more likely to vote. They're completely integrated. But the New York City Police Department, which was monitoring what was going on in European capitals very closely, felt that what was happening in Europe would happen in the United States about 5 years later than it began happening in Europe. And I think that is correct. And just as we see in Europe converts getting involved in this faddish jihad, also we're seeing converts get involved in the United States. And terrorism does run in waves. There was a period when anarchists were the most important terrorists. That was early in the century. Then we had nationalist groups like the PLO, some of them left-wing extremist groups like the Baader-Meinhof gang or the Red Brigades in Italy or the Weather Underground in the United States. Those groups, although they haven't completely disappeared, you very rarely hear about them now. Recently, we've seen the rise of Islamist terrorism, and Islamist extremists are far and away the most successful terrorists operating today in terms of recruitment and mobilization. But this, too, will pass, I believe, and I don't think we'll be talking about Islamist terrorism 20 years from now if you and I sit down again.
You really don't?
I don't. I think that very likely it will be some other kind of terrorism that will rise to the fore.
Well, and some people would be incredulous to hear that. You know, each of the groups that you mentioned had a specific issue in almost a specific area. This feels global, and as we're seeing, you've got a woman in Pennsylvania who suddenly turns up in Sweden trying to kill a cartoonist. So this feels as if it could keep morphing and taking on other lives and stay longer than you've said.
Well, one of the ways that it does appear to have morphed is that jihadis inspired or maybe even affiliated with al-Qaeda appear to be prepared to carry out smaller-scale attacks in Western cities. We know from strategy manuals that have been captured by U.S. forces that al-Qaeda initially was only interested in major, large-scale attacks, and that is no longer true.
Well, in fact, we have the American-born al-Qaeda spokesperson Adam Gadan. In a recent internet posting, he made a public pitch for smaller, single acts of jihad. And as you said, that's sort of turning upside down the notion that al-Qaeda is calling for bigger attacks. But doesn't that seem to make the point? Again, this is an American-born who seems to be going against the al-Qaeda thinking, and it's morphed.
It has morphed. And it's morphed, on the one hand, in a way that makes the movement harder to track, but at the same time, not quite as dangerous.
I want to go through a list that you drew up after the Fort Hood shootings. Myths of who becomes a terrorist, and you tell me the yes or no. Here's the thinking. Most are spoiled rich kids.
The answer is no. Not all terrorists are spoiled rich kids.
Well, the two women that we're talking about were struggling, one a single mom. The thinking that terrorists are motivated by a strong belief in their cause, and they may be motivated by a feeling of humiliation.
Yes, I think humiliation is absolutely key, and humiliation can be personal, and it can also be a feeling of civilizational humiliation. And the question is, why is it that some young people feel more connected with humiliated people living abroad than they do with their neighbors inside America or in Europe?
That is interesting. There's plenty of people to get angry about. Well, I'm thinking, you know, in some of the small towns around Philadelphia, there's plenty of injustices to be indignant about. Why reach out to a doctor in Egypt?
I really do see this jihad, while I don't mean to belittle its importance, I see it as a faddish way to protest the powers that be. It is a fad.
Yeah. And the final thinking, that the typical terrorist is an alienated loner. In both of the cases of these women, one had a man that she lived with, who's stunned to know that she was even on the internet this much. Another had family, step-parents that, you know, she obviously interacted with a lot. They had, through her, a grandchild. They weren't alone.
No, but more importantly, they are being recruited or recruiting themselves into a movement where they have a kind of collective identity, and that is key. This idea of jihad is providing that identity to some of these people we're hearing about now.
That's Jessica Stern. She lectures on public policy at Harvard Law School, serves on the Hoover Institute Task Force on National Security and Law, and wrote the book Terror in the Name of God, Why Religious Militants Kill. Jessica, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
In Peter Hedges' new novel, a young family grows in Brooklyn. Tim Welch is a history teacher at a private school. He says his wife, Kate, married down. She, after all, once dated the actor Jeff Slade, or, as Tim puts it, yes, that Jeff Slade. But now Tim and Kate crave the ordinary. She calls him when son Sam has his first poop. Tim cries when Kate promises not to flush till he gets home.
After hanging up, I wiped my eyes and thought, life can't get better. There was no person in history with whom I would want to change places. And I'm an ordinary man, which made this feeling all the more improbable. Please understand, I'm a great believer in lowering expectations. From a young age, I learned to speak the worst about myself, expect the least, and later, if lucky, be surprised to find out I'd been wrong. So am I ordinary? In the best sense, yes.
Author Peter Hedges has also written several plays and was nominated for an Oscar for his adaptation of his first novel, What's Eating Gilbert Grape. He's also the writer-director of the films Pieces of April and Dan in Real Life. His new novel is called The Heights, and like his character Tim Welch, Peter is also a nice transplant from the Midwest to Brooklyn. He joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Hi.
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 See, now you still sound so Midwestern.
I know. We started to talk, and I suddenly was back in Iowa. I can't help it.
So you're an Iowan, which is where Gilbert Grape is set.
Correct.
Transported to Brooklyn Heights.
That's right.
And what did that do to you?
Actually, I feel like I found a part of New York that feels very much like Iowa. One thing about Iowa that I found growing up was that everybody knew my business, and if I misbehaved, my dad or mom would certainly get the call. That's kind of the case living in the Heights. People know you, and you know people, and you keep your head down.
You know, it's a surprise to a lot of people because, again, we think of Brooklyn or New York as being this bustling city, and a lot of people may not even know about Brooklyn Heights. Maybe the first glimpse they had was, sadly, on 9/11, where we saw all those photographs of the people gathered in Brooklyn Heights on the promenade there, looking back
that's
at
right.
the World Trade Towers.
In my office, I walk right out my door and turn right, and that's the place
yeah.
where everyone was.
So tell us a little bit about this Brooklyn Heights that this kid from Iowa found. What is Brooklyn Heights?
Well, when you're the parents of small children, you enter a particular world, which is the world of parents with small children. And you're all sleep-deprived, and your kids all play together, and you cling to this notion that maybe you'll get to hang with adults that you enjoy and that their kids will get along with yours.
Yeah.
And it's that dynamic that made the Heights for me and my friends a smaller community.
Right, because it's a tree-lined street of old brick houses. It's very
small
and intimate.
One of the most beautiful parts of any city I've ever encountered.
It's gorgeous. So you and your wife lived in this area, and your characters, Tim and Kate, live there. Are you Tim and Kate?
No.
Do you know Tim and Kate?
I did draw, you know, some details from my life or the lives of my friends, but this isn't a memoir. This is what could happen to a well-intended couple that have a great ordinary love. How easy it is, even when you have that great love, to get lost. I was interested in exploring, wanted to write about a marriage, and a good marriage, and a good marriage being tested.
This is a great marriage. Tim's wife gets an opportunity to work for the Foundation for, what is it,
Foundation for an Ethical Future.
Right. Tim decides to become a stay-at-home dad because he's been desperate to finish his dissertation anyway. So now he's subbing for his wife at the playground, in the coffee shop. Into their lives comes Anna Brody, fabulously wealthy, beautiful, somewhat mysterious, the kind of person you see a lot in New York. Absolutely no offense to Iowa, but probably not the kind of creature you might see in an ordinary neighborhood.
No, I only saw that in fifth grade with Joni Jerome in Iowa. No, Anna Brody is extraordinary in the wonderful way that Tim and Kate are ordinary. You know, one of the questions that really drove me in writing this novel, which is this notion of what is enough? I love a story that's a wake-up story, that kind of story that when you read it and you close it, you see more vividly what's in front of you. And that's what I hope happens to the reader, that you ask yourselves, what's enough? And if you don't have enough, then go about getting what you need. But maybe we don't need as much as we think we need.
Well, Anna sort of poses that question for both Kate and Tim because, as she says, she's fabulously wealthy. She's got these incredible clothing that, you know, and Kate wants to be her friend. And Tim might start wanting something else. But then Kate also has her world knocked a little bit because her old boyfriend, the aforementioned actor Jeff Slade, comes back into her life. And he's also fabulously wealthy and famous. That happens a lot in New York, too, that you can't help but see this wealth all around you.
I do think there's probably a more comparison thinking that goes on where you look and say, gee, they have a house that we don't have, or they went to this school and I only went to that school. Where there's fabulousness, it's more fabulous than maybe in the Midwest, where I feel that we were more apt to try to find a consensus and nobody wanted to stand out too much in New York. This is a generalization, of course.
Of course, huge generalizations, yes.
But I think that collision, the ordinary colliding with the extraordinary, and that maybe the extraordinary isn't so extraordinary, and maybe the ordinary is much more extraordinary than they could have ever imagined. That collision was just interesting to me.
Oh, it's a wonderful read. We're not going to give away the ending.
Okay.
I just want to mention one thing. While Tim is considering whether or not he should have an affair with Anna Brody, he's still this solid Midwesterner as he does it, because he makes a pledge to God. If God gives him the signs.
Three signs.
Three, not just one.
Right.
It's almost like he wants God to help him.
Help him.
Do it.
Or help him not do it.
Yeah.
In a way. Part of the fun of writing a novel, as opposed to the film work I do and the plays I've written, is that you get to get inside how people think. And thought is where the gold is in a novel, or I think in this novel. And for me to get to just sink into how Tim and Kate think and how they operate based on what they believe to be true. And of course, the reader knows more about their marriage than Tim and Kate know about their marriage. So it has an interesting effect, I think, because it's told from these dueling points of view.
By the way, you started writing this book almost 12 years ago.
I did.
So much changed. The World Trade Towers that these people in Brooklyn Heights used to look at collapsed.
Mm-hmm.
Wall Street, a little further down on Manhattan, collapsed as well.
Yes.
And again, without giving away too much of the ending, but there's sort of a collapse of a sense of whether or not these fabulously wealthy people are all that fabulous by the end of the book as well.
Yes. That's the danger of coveting, of imagining that it's better elsewhere. You may lose sight of what you have. I mean, I live around people who have incredible homes, and some of those homes are for sale now, and some of them leave in the night.
Yeah. That's Peter Hedges. His new book, a fictionalized version of the place where he lives, is called The Heights. It's the story of a young couple living in the Brooklyn neighborhood of the same name. Do I smell movie?
Oh, I think it would be a really pleasurable film to make.
Do you write with that in mind now that you've done so many films? Or,
well, if I'd wanted to make it a film, I would have just gone right to it. I really wanted to live in how they think. But I really enjoy these two. I enjoy the others too, some of the other characters a great deal. And since I now direct films as well, I could imagine living a little longer with them.
Peter Hedges, thanks so much.
Thank you.